Okay, so we will be looking at a koan from the Book of Equanimity, case number 54, Ungarn and the Great Mercy. Introduction. Transparent on eight sides, totally open in ten directions, emitting light and shaking the earth in all places, exercising supernatural deeds and subtle functions at all times. Tell me, how could this be manifested? The case. Ungarn asked Dogo, what does the Bodhisattva of the Great Mercy do when she uses her hands, her manifold hands and eyes? Dogo answered, it is like a person in the middle of the night reaching with his hand behind the head, groping for his pillow. Ungarn said, I get it. Dogo said, how do you get it? Ungarn said, the whole body is hands and eyes. Dogo said, you said it very well, but you expressed just eighth tenth of it. Ungarn said, how would you say it, elder brother? Dogo said, the entire body is hands and eyes. Verse, one whole, void and open. Transparent on eight sides, without form, without eye, spring takes its shape. Unobstructed and unhindered, the moon travels through the firmament. Pure treasure eyes, arms of virtue, the whole body and the entire body, how do they compare with each other? The hands and eyes at this moment manifest the entire activities. The great function, vertical and horizontal, how could they detest anything at all? So here we have a lovely koan by Ungarn, sorry, by talking about Dogo and Ungarn. As I explained many times before, the Book of Equanimity, here's a copy of it, was compiled in the 12th century by Master Wenshi. He also wrote the verse of it. Master Wenshi was from the Soto school. I'll talk about that in a minute. And about 100 years later, Master Bansho added the commentary, which is the introduction here as well. What I'd like to talk about a little bit before we get into it is about Soto and Rinzai. I've talked about it before, and it's always important to give some context on those two different schools as well. As you know, our school is the Zanbo Zen school, also used to be known as Zanbo Kyodan. And they have all their, each school has its own flavor. And I'd just like to read out what Yasutani Roshi, so remember, Yasutani Roshi is actually the founder of the school, of the Sanbo Zen school. Even though Harada Roshi was instrumental in starting it, but it is Yasutani that actually incorporated it as a and got it through the system as in a as a as a as a, as a proper incorporated body under the Japanese system. So Yasutani is really the founder. Both Yasutani and Harada Roshi were in the Soto school. And but as you know, and I've explained it a few times, they weren't satisfied and went got permission from their Soto masters to go into the Rinzai curriculum training, into a Rinzai curriculum training, and that is where they gained profound understanding about the Dharma. And so when they started a new school for various reasons, they incorporated the Rinzai koan practice as part of the Soto school. But I'd just like to just read out what Yasutani said about this. So Master Engo, who gave the preface and commentary to each case of the Blue Cliff Record, so that's the Blue Creek Record, and Master Wenshi, which is the one that compiled this particular book, this book here, were of approximately the same generation. Okay. Both men were close Dharma friends. But whether we speak of their views, so they had different views regarding Zen, or of their teaching policies, each had its own distinctive characteristics, and each took a position from which he did not yield an inch. So they were very, very dogmatic by the sounds of it. right from the special characteristics of Soto and Rinzai Zen, oozed out right from them, the special characteristics of Sotai and Rinzai Zen oozed out. So the first one, which is the book of the Blue Cliff Record, is a Rinzai collection, because simply the collector of those koans was in the Rinzai school. And this one is a Soto collection, simply because that, you know, whoever compiled it is from the Soto school. So they didn't ooze an inch from their position, as in what is Rinzai and what is Soto. Okay. I think it is most desirable, this is Yasutani saying this, that Zen students become intimately familiar with both the Blue Cliff Record and the Book of Equanimity. And of course, in our tradition, we do both the Book of Equanimity and the Blue Cliff Record. Okay. And make the strong points of both Rinzai Zen and Soto Zen their own. Okay. Just I'd like to add something to this. We've got to remember, in those days, when Yasutani was alive, obviously he wrote this when he was alive, that whole notion of creating another school outside of Soto and Rinzai was fairly new and, you know, quite frankly, radical. You know, nowadays we don't even think twice about it. We say, oh, we're part of the Zanbo Zen school, and we don't think of Rinzai and Soto as being really, we just accept it, okay? But in those days, in many ways, they had to justify it, especially to their contemporaries, you know? And even today, I don't think contemporary Soto and Rinzai hierarchies in Japan will accept the Zanbo Zen school as authentic. You know, just to let you know that they stick to their own. This is, you know, if you like, it's a Protestant movement, Zanbo Zen. Protestant as in they were protesting. They weren't happy with Soto and Rinzai as having their own distinctive teachings and classifications. So the combination of that is what is Protestant about it. About Zanbo Zen, and of course the other part is that this is a householder lineage, which is completely new. It wasn't a monastic lineage, you know. So you can see that. Look at Zanbo Zen as a Protestant movement, similar to what Luther did when in Christianity way back when he was criticizing the Catholics and their methods, if you like. So just that aside, okay. So Rinzai and Soto have their respective strong points. This is Yasutani again, and weak points. But since strong points are liable to change into weak points by correctly learning each kind of Zen, the strong points of both are taken in. And one is saved from the early engendered shortcomings and ill effects of both. I believe this is important, Yasutani says, to become attached to one-sided sectarian pride and for one sect to exclude the other are things with which I find it difficult to concur. In stating, I put samadhi, so this is obviously concentration and single-pointed meditation concentration, foremost, and wisdom afterwards, Master Wenshi promoted the cultivation of samadhi or joriki through energetic sitting. But of course, he also stressed seeing one's nature, attaining enlightenment, as he is clear when we consider the appreciative verses in the Book of Equanimity. As a contrast to this, stating I put wisdom forward, which is Rinzai, I put wisdom foremost and samadhi afterwards, Master Engo settles beforehand the problem of seeing one's nature and attaining enlightenment. So which one is more important? You know, one or the other. So that's the debate, if you like. And follows up with the cultivation of samadhi power as his method. In such fashion, the policies and emphasis regarding Zen were utterly different. But it seems that their Dharma relationship was always warm-hearted. Wenshi, on the eve of his death, left his affairs entirely in Engo's hands. So they were friends, and so obviously he was a very good friend to leave all his affairs in his hands when he died. And Engo, on his part, responded by discharging his trust well. And he says, it is my hope that we too, having such wise men as our mirror, in utter freedom may work at guiding others by discarding sectarian pride. Okay, now this is Yasutani's take on that. And also I wanted to read out just something very quickly on what Yamada Roshi. So Yamada, of course, Kōen Roshi was a student of Yasutani. And Yamada was also the student of Roslin of Mervyn of myself. And the present abbot, of course, was a son of Yamada Roshi as well. That's why he's called Yamada as well, just to let you know that. Okay, so this is what Kōen Yamada said. Okay. One difference between the Soto school and Rinzai school is that the Soto school does not try to forcibly bring about a Kensho experience. As I'm always saying, the Soto school has more a tendency that could be characterized as waiting on the ground for the persimmon to ripen. Lovely image. Waiting on the ground for the persimmon to ripen. Let me read that again. I missed something here. Where are we? So as I'm always saying, the Soto school has more tendency that could be characterized as waiting on the ground for the persimmon to ripen on the tree and fall of its own volition on the ground. So the persimmon ripens on the tree, like our practice ripens through sitting. And of course, through our own volition, falling onto the ground. So dropping body and mind, letting that just happen very naturally, okay, without any type of forcement at all. We sit like we're already there. You know, just that's the Soto approach. Okay. That means the true natural flavor emerges. The true natural flavor emerges. You know, it's like eating a ripe fruit versus a green fruit. The Rinzai school could be characterized as picking the fruit when it's still green. Okay, we're picking the fruit when it's still green. And then pickling it in shoshushu liquor, or you could say strawberry liquor, or whatever it is, or steaming it to bring out the sweetness with artificial means. Okay. With artificial means, that's what he says. It might be sweet, but actually it takes time for the real flavor to come out. Okay. Recently, this is Yamada Roshi saying this, I've been musing about where the difference lies. Okay. If a true ripened flavor emerges, the result is the same. So the result is the same. In the case of the Rinzai school, there is almost always a dividing line between the state before Kensho and following Kensho. So we make that line, okay? Before Kensho, following. Before Kensho, you don't get into koans, after Kensho. So we have this line, okay? Even though we might speak in terms of attaining Kensho, as long as this dividing line remains, it is still not the genuine article. As long as this dividing line remains, it hasn't ripened yet. We're dividing. It's still not a genuine article. Yeah. It's a matter of this true ripening, and I can't help feeling that such cases can be found more frequently in the Soto school in the koans. Okay. So the reason I'd like to point this out, the reason I thought this was very interesting, is we obviously, you know, some people get frustrated because they haven't got Kensho, you know. And in our school, you know, we of course, you know, we teach the Kōen Mu as a way of, as a hautau, as a keyword, in order to penetrate what Mu is. And then that hopefully solicits, that solicits some experience maybe. It pushes us along, if you like. So that's a function of it. But at the same time, we keep sitting. And as I always say, the practice on the cushion is sitting. Off the cushion, we may repeat the koan, and we let it happen, but ripening happens on the cushion, you know. So even though some people may not necessarily get a Kensho experience, you know, within a few years, that doesn't mean that nothing is happening. that ripening process is always happening as we are sitting, you know, and that is very important. And remember that most students of Zen, they don't even teach koans like we do. That is just a Rinzai. And the Soto school is a much bigger school than the Rinzai school, by the way. So I just like to bring that out and just, you know, also stress that, you know, how grateful I am that we have a school that does not take sides, you know, that we are, you know, in a position to deal with unripened, if you like, persimmons and ripened persimmons, you know. And by the way, that I'm also grateful that we can pick unripened persimmons, because that's what koan work is all about. That the whole koan work is about getting that sweetness out. It's ripening the process. You know, he calls it artificial means. You know, I don't know if I would have called it artificial means, but in a way, it is. That also in itself is a very important practice that we've inherited, and it's a lovely practice, especially and certainly for those that are doing it. Most people like it. Okay, so let's get to the koan now. Introduction. So this is by Bansho. Transparent on eight sides, totally open in 10 directions, emitting light and shaking the earth in all places, exercising supernatural deeds and subtle functions at all times. Tell me, how could this be manifested? Okay. So transparent on eight sides, totally open in 10 directions. So it's talking. What is transparent? What is transparent on eight sides, totally open in 10 directions? You know, remember, koans are always about our true self. So if you don't know, just that's what it is. In most cases, it's our true self. Of course, it's another thing to realize what the true self is. But this is what it's saying: the true self, transparent on eight sides. So eight sides is a bit strange, but eight sides, it's like east, west, north, south. So that's four for both inside and out, or inside and outside. That's an up and down. That's eight. So yeah, that's how it works. Yeah, transparent on eight sides and open in 10 directions. So you got eight and a two, which is 10. So according to what I've been reading. So that's how they make it. But that's not important. What is important is our true self is transparent and open. So here the image is, it is totally transparent. No matter from which way you're looking at it, it is open and transparent. There is nothing that is obstructing it. You know, that is what he's saying, open and transparent. Eight sides, from this side, and up and down. And then the 10 directions, which is the up and down. Okay, in the 10 directions. Eight sides in the 10 direction. Totally free. Totally free. And that is, so it starts off with that. You know, transparent on eight sides, totally open in 10 directions. Totally, total freedom. Emitting light and shaking the earth in all places. So emitting light, the light, emitting light, and at the same time shaking, rattling the earth, you know, shaking the earth. Now again, this is talking about our true self, emitting light. In other words, it is so bright, you know, it is so bright. It shines everywhere, nothing is hidden. Shaking, look at that earthquake in Turkey, shaking the earth, you know, standing, moving, driving, leaves falling, eating, sleeping, swimming, earthquakes, war, shaking the earth, our truth, shaking the earth, you know, in the 10 directions, emitting light and shaking the earth in all places, exercising supernatural deeds and subtle functions at all times. Exercising supernatural. So again, it talks about, is our sensual nature exercising supernatural deeds? I mean, supernatural deeds, remember when this was written, nowadays we would be a bit sus if someone says supernatural. But actually, you know, you could say that which we don't see is supernatural. We refer to what is natural or what is analytic or what is logical as something that we can comprehend. You can say that, you know, exercising uncomprehendable deeds is another way of looking at it, or incomprehensible deeds, you know. If I look at paperclip again, you know, I look at the paperclip really as, you know, I've been taught that this is a paperclip. You know, whereas Raf, you have babies, you're going to teach Clear, you know, paperclip, daddy, mommy, you know, sky, you know, car. And then what happens? The association between paperclip and the word paperclip becomes conditioned. So that's paperclip, you know. But is this really paperclip? What is supernatural about this paperclip is, of course, it's dependent on every, there is no such thing as paperclip. Paperclip is dependent on so many things, incountable things. Paperclip is dependent on metal. It's dependent on there being paper. It's depending on the person that was born that invented it. It's dependent on office works, because I bought it at office works. So the whole Coles scenario, it's dependent on water, because without water, there wouldn't be this earth. There wouldn't be metal. It's depending on metal, iron ore. It's this paperclip in its entire function is nothing other than the entire universe. You take time out of the equation only now. It's everything is paperclip. That is what we need to see. That is what he refers to, exercising supernatural deeds and subtle functions. Now, functions, what are the functions? Paperclip. There you go, there's the function. So we have this phenomena that is everything at the same time, all the time, and then we've got the function of the phenomena. You know, of course, we don't look at it that way because we've been taught, nah, this is paperclip. There's nothing else but paperclip, and that is a phone, and that is some glass of water, and that is it, and we're stuck there. We're stuck in seeing it that way. So this is something to look at, exercising supernatural deeds and subtle functions at all times. So ordinarily we don't see it. Tell me, how could this be manifested? So how can this be manifested? So that's the question that is asked in the introduction. How could this be manifested? Of course, it always refers to that. How can it be manifested? And now there's an example, and the example is the case. Okay, that's the koan. So this is the koan now. Case. I'll read it out again. Ungan asked Dogo, what does the Bodhisattva of the Great Mercy use so many hands and eyes for? Dogo answered, it is like a person in the middle of the night reaching with his hands behind his head, groping for his pillow. Ungan said, I get it. Dogo said, how do you get it? Ungan said, the whole body is hands and eyes. Dogo said, you said it very well, but you expressed just 1/10 of it. Ungan said, how would you say it, elder brother? Dogo said, the entire body is hands and eyes. Apparently, it took Odo 40 years to get to realize. There's another bit of information that I read. 40 years, so that's obviously a long time. It's one of the longest I've read, actually. It took him 40, but that example is quite often used as in don't get discouraged. It's only 40 years, yeah. Yeah, so anyway, I just thought I'd mention that as well. 40 years is nothing, it's just like that, you know. But of course, 40 years, that doesn't mean it, you know, it takes everyone 40 years, you know, 40 years to ripen. You know, the longer we sit and the longer, so a Kensho experience can happen in the moment of fully ripening, if you like, and it's ripened Kensho, or it can happen in a green way, and then it needs to be nurtured through koan work. You know, so these things, that's how it works as well. So it's never, whatever we do in our practice, it's not just waiting for Kensho. Every practice opportunity that we take, you know, adds to that ripening process. Okay, Ungan asked Dogo, let's look at the first sentence. What does the Bodhisattva of the Great Mercy do when she uses her manifold hands and eyes? So Bodhisattva, of course, Bodhi, as I've explained many times before, means awakened. Sattva is a being, so an awakened being. Okay. Now, of the Great Mercy is Avalokitesvara. Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara is the Bodhisattva of the Great Mercy. Okay. So Bodhisattva is a Mahayana concept. Let's put it this way. The Buddha was supposed to have been a Bodhisattva, according to the Pali canon. So it was certainly there in the early Buddhist schools as well. But the Mahayana have taken that concept much further than the initial schools have. Link remove. You might have to press that link button again. Is it linked? Can you hear us on Zoom? We've just had a little technical issue here. Okay. Is that green light on? Yeah. Okay. So I should. Yeah, good. Thank you, Steve. Okay. So the Bodhisattva is Avalokitesvara that we're talking about here. There are many different Bodhisattvas. Okay. Also different definitions of Bodhisattvas. A Bodhisattva can be already someone that is just starting on the path, and it can be someone really well and truly on the path already. Okay, different interpretations. But I just again like to offer you a definition and a little bit of history on the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, if I may. A good time, yes. Because we recite we make quite often reference to Avalokitesvara. What is interesting is that we need to, that Buddhist traditions, various Buddhist traditions have a different relationship and also a different understanding of what the Bodhisattva Avalokitesvara, or generally what Bodhisattva or deities are. Okay, so we'll just go through that just quickly. This is from the Stanford Buddhist Dictionary. Avalokitesvara, a Chinese Guanyin, or Kuan Yin in Japanese canon in Buddhism, and primarily in Mahayana Buddhism, the Bodhisattva, they call the Buddha to be of infinite compassion and mercy, possibly the most popular of all figures in Buddhist legend. I would say in Mahayana legend. I don't know if I would go as far as Buddhist legend. Avalokitesvara is beloved throughout the Buddhist world, not only in Mahayana Buddhism, but also Theravada, Way of the Elders. The branch of Buddhism that largely does not recognize Bodhisattvas, and in the Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle, the tantric or esoteric branch of Buddhism, which is mainly in Tibetan, even though in that particular part of Tibetan, because the Tibetan very much appreciate Avalokitesvara. I don't know if you know, but the Dalai Lama is a reincarnation of Avalokitesvara according to that school in Buddhism. So he is a prime example of it. Okay. Avalokitesvara supremely exemplifies the Bodhisattva's resolve. Avalokitesvara supremely exemplifies the Bodhisattva's resolve to postpone his or her own Buddhahood until he or she has helped every sentient being on earth achieve liberation. remember what the vow, the four great vows, is a bodhisattva vow as well, that we chant, four great vows. So in an arahant, for instance, which is the ideal of Theravada, bodhisattva is the ideal of Mahayana Buddhism, in the ideal changes. Bodhisattva is there to serve all beings, serve all beings, till everyone is enlightened. The arahant is practicing in order to become liberated. So some people in Mahayana criticize the Theravada tradition, saying that it's a very selfish thing to do, you know. But of course it isn't. I won't go into that argument at the moment. Okay, from suffering. To achieve liberation from suffering. So that's the goal. And the process of death and rebirth. So in other words, getting out of that karmic cycle of rebirth. Okay, that is sort of the bodhisattva does everything he or she can through multiple lifetimes, according to Buddhist legend, in order to achieve that. So the name has been variously interpreted as the Lord who looks in every direction and the Lord of what we see, that is the actual created world. In Tibet, he is known as Spayen Ras Gzix, with a pitying look. And in Mongolia, as Nidu Bu, I can't say that, he who looks with the eyes. The title invariably used for him in Cambodia and Thailand is Lokiteshvara, Lord of the World. In China, where he is often worshipped in female form, is Guanyin, Hears Cries. In Sri Lanka, he is known as Natha Deva, often mistakenly confused as Maitreya, the Buddha yet to come. Avalokiteshvara is the earthly manifestation of the self-born eternal Buddha Amitabha. So that is, if you go into the Pure Land School, they have, whose figure is represented in his headless and he guards, sorry, whose figure is represented in his headdress, and he guards the world in the interval between the departure of the historical Buddha, Gautama, and the appearance of the future Buddha, Maitreya. Okay, so he guards the world. Avalokiteshvara protects against shipwrecks, fire, assassins, robbers, wild beasts. He is the creator of the fourth world, which is the actual universe. So these are all what people believe in different traditions, believe in Buddhism, that Avalokiteshvara is. It's a little bit like the Christianity, like the saints. Okay. According to legend, his head once split with grief at realizing the number of wicked beings in the world yet to be saved. Amitabha caused each of the pieces to become a whole head and placed them on his son in three tiers of three. Then the tenth and topped them all with his own image. Sometimes the 11-headed Avalokiteshvara is represented with thousands of arms. Okay, so now that comes back to the koan, with thousands of arms, which rise like the outspread tail of a peacock around him. So when you look at that little picture that I've got there, you see different heads and you see the thousands of arms, okay, on there. The virtues and miracles of Avalokiteshvara are accounted in many Buddhist sutras and scriptures. And there's even a sutra named after him or her incorporated into the widely popular Lotus Sutra, 3rd century. The height of the veneration of Avalokiteshvara was in northern India. I won't go too much into it anymore, but I thought what I'd like to stress here is that Buddhism, like different, obviously there are different countries that practice different types of Buddhisms. Avalokiteshvara seems to be a central figure in all of them, but including gender, I mean, it's changed according to whatever conditions were taught at the time. And so Avalokiteshvara is a central figure in Buddhism and also in Zen, of course. Now it comes down to the koan, because now the question that was asked is a question in the koan. How does Zen look at this? Okay. And when you look at the case, you know, Ungan Astogo, What does the Bodhisattva of Great Mercy, Avalokiteshvara, do when she, so Chinese, so it's a she form, she uses her manifold hands and eyes? Okay. What does she do? That's the question that was asked. Okay. So, Dogo answered, it's like a person in the middle of the night reaching with his or her hands, you could say, behind his head, groping for his pillow. Okay. So, actually, I woke up today, of course, obviously had a coin in my mind, and I was groping for my pillow, and I had a big laugh in the middle of the night. I had a big laugh. So, you know, but really, this is really what we've got to get our head around. Avalokiteshvara. What is Avalokiteshvara? We, of course, can get stuck in the mythology, in the history. We can get stuck in the belief. Similar to, you know, Christians can also get stuck in the beliefs of the saints. Was Avalokiteshvara a real person? I don't know. Certainly it's full of legends here. Maybe, maybe not. Could be. We don't know. But the way it is written down, you know, the way it is explained is there is a lot of mythology there. You know, nowadays, of course, as you know, with our access to scriptures and texts and analysis that is being done, we can get a picture and say, oh, look how different Buddhist schools are looking at this. Okay. And then it seems ridiculous saying, oh, one thinks it's a she, the other one thinks it's a he. They were the first people that were truly had no identity. And also then what that represents. We can get really hung up on that. You know. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, you know, how often do we get hung up on that? I'm not just talking about bodhisattvas and Avalokiteshvara, but how often do we get hung up? Like hung up on paperclip. We are hung up on paperclip. Just like we are hung up on Avalokiteshvara. This is just as ridiculous saying this is a paperclip. As it is, you know, our notion of paperclip and what it really is, worlds apart. Worlds apart. And that is the same as when we look at Avalokiteshvara. So here, the answer that he gives, it's a person in the middle of the night reaching for his hand behind his head, groping for his pillow. That is the function of the many hands, of the many hands of Avalokiteshvara. You know. So we can look at it as a folk story. We can look at it as a piety of some sort of piety. You know, people revere Avalokiteshvara. They put incense in front of Avalokiteshvara. They got images of, you know, in their cars, if you drive around Buddhist countries, of Avalokiteshvara. They're praying to Avalokiteshvara, please help me have a baby. That's a big one, you know, to Avalokiteshvara, just like the Christians pray to their saints, you know. So Avalokiteshvara is a symbol. So it's a symbol of something, just like paperclip is a symbol. We cannot be without symbols, because that is how we, again, communicate. That is how we function. We function through symbology, you know. When you look at, again, coming back to the Christian, you know, tradition, same thing. There is, you know, you might even say that Jesus is a symbol, or God is a symbol. Or you might say God is a word for our true self. And then another intermediary is someone like Jesus. That gets us closer to that as an intermediary. Just like paperclip is really important as an intermediary. I need to be able to, I'm not going to throw the word paperclip away or its function away. I need that intermediary paperclip in order to say, pass me the paperclip. And I know the function of a paperclip in order to put two pieces of papers together. I need that. But it's still a symbol. So it's the same with Avalokiteshvara. We don't know whether when he asked that question, you know, whether he knew that or not, or whether he was just looking at Avalokiteshvara, Dogo was looking at or Ungarn was looking at Avalokiteshvara as a figure of to be revered. We don't know that. But the answer, of course, is it's like groping for a pillow. You know, that takes us beyond the symbol of what it is. You know, of course, this is what Zen does. So what does it actually get us to look at if it's not a symbol? Because if you look at it from language, and if you start thinking about it, you cannot help but fall back on another symbol. Always fall back on another symbol, so it can't win. So we really need to see what it is beyond the symbol of it. You know, we call that the fact in Zen. What is the fact of Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva? What is the fact of paperclip? That's the question. If we cannot find that, we're stuck. We're stuck in symbology. We're stuck in the symbol, or we call it concepts. We're stuck in the concept of Avalokiteshvara, or the concept of Jesus, or the concept of paperclip, or the concept of Buddha, or the concept of Zen. Doesn't matter. They're all words that we use. Or the concept of true self. So, very powerful. Okay. We have these symbols, these intermediaries, if you like. And the question, of course, and this is something that a koan, you know, is designed to get us beyond the symbology of it. But we fall back on it, of course, if we want to make meaning, if we want to add, or if we want to communicate about it. But we gotta go behind it. And as I've mentioned before, the fact of paperclip is, if I can see paperclip or Avalokiteshvara or Bodhisattva, whatever it is, if I can see it without getting stuck in symbology, and the word that I like to use is without remainder, without add-on, without anything remaining. And then we get to this notion of it's just this. And even that, just this, is already too much. You know, we get to that notion, it's just this. So you hear that quite often and say, oh, it's just this, just sitting, just sitting. Just sitting is sitting without remainder. But just sitting is also a paperclip. If you really see that just sitting, then all of a sudden, sitting is no longer, there's no boundary between sitting and standing and paperclip. No remainder is boundless, and that's the freedom that is all free in all directions, 8 or 10 or whatever many they have. It is boundless. It is boundless, you know. That's the freedom. And we can access that. And that is what meant when we're free. And this is, it's just like groping at night, catching your pillow. Sometimes I bash my pillow because it's just not soft enough. You know, bang, bang, bang. I don't know if you've ever done that. Scrunch it up. And you lay back down again and you're free, you know. There's no interference, you know. It's lovely, no interference. So Dogo answered it like that. It is just like a person in the middle of the night reaching with his hands behind his head, groping for his pillow. This fella, Ida, in the Yama does Teisho on this, he said, when there is no I, there is nothing which is not I. Isn't that lovely? When there is no I, there is nothing which is not I. Because I is another symbol. I is the biggest symbol that holds us back of all. Because that is, but if there is no I, if there is no I, there is nothing that is not I. You know, it's just a really powerful example of this. So Ungarn then said, I get it. Watch it when people say, I get it. I get it. Okay, I get it. So he got it. Okay, Ungarn said, I get it. So of course, Dogo said, how? How did you get it? You know, how did you get it? And Ungarn said, the whole body and eyes. The whole body is hands and eyes. The whole body is hands and eyes. Meaning the whole universe is hands and eyes. No distinction between paperclip and I and Avalokiteshvara. The whole universe. The whole universe. Is hands and eyes, and there you see all those hands on the boat. That is a beautiful, again, symbol of this notion of the whole universe's eyes and hands, the functioning of the universe, earthquakes, whatever it is. No matter what we put in front of our eyes, we see it. It doesn't matter what, even if I'm blind, I see something. I always see something. Yeah, that's the whole function of its hands and eyes. Yeah. Dogo said, you said it very well, but you expressed just 8/10. So you just expressed 8/10 of it. So 80%. I give you 80% for that answer. I give you 80% of that answer. Okay, for that answer. Only 80%. Okay. So, by the way, Ungarn then said when he was... Ungarn said in reply to his 80%, okay, how would you say it, elder brother? So what would be your response, you know, to something like that, you know? And he said, the entire body is hands and eyes, you know. So the entire body is hands and eyes. So there's a difference here. The whole body is hands and eyes, and the entire body is hands and eyes. Someone asked, why did Ungarn not challenge him and say, what do you mean? What's the difference between whole body or entire body? You know? And the answer one of the masters gave us, that is what makes Ungarn such a powerful master. Because he didn't challenge it. You know? Anyway, I'll let you sit with that. So what is the difference between the whole body is hands and eyes and the entire body is hands and eyes? That is a question for the Dokusan room. What's the difference between the entire and the whole body? So that's something that needs to be answered in the Dokusan room. Okay, let's go to the verse by Wan Chi. One whole void and open. Okay, one whole void and open. Various interpretations about what one whole void or what one whole actually is. I personally don't know. I was reading an article the other day in the Tricycle magazine about zero. Did anyone read that by any chance? I haven't got enough time to mention it, but that notion of zero, it is, when you look at the mathematics of that, of zero, it is incredible. It was, by the way, invented, zero was invented by an Indian around that time, when I say that time, I think it was thirds, you might know. Do you know when zero was invented? No, you don't. What good is a PhD in mathematics? Yeah. Anyway, zero was invented, and of course it changed mathematics forever. But the notion of zero is that something can be added that is nothing. There's nothing at all. And yet, it's everything. You know, zero is nothing, and yet it is everything. So that you can link it, say, the whole, as in an emptiness, if you like. But again, void and open. Okay, void and open. Void. So it's void and open. Void, as in it's got no. Like this is void. It's got no self. We say it's a paperclip. But actually, it's void of paperclip, because the only thing that makes this a paperclip is the word paperclip. And also, you know, what makes this a paperclip? It has not got a self-identity. If I swallow it, is it still a paperclip? And if it eventually, I won't swallow it, but if eventually it dissolves, where's the paperclip? Like, you know, so can we really say that this is a paperclip? I mean, that is, we might say we call this a paperclip, but we can't say, because it has got no self-identity. Okay, so that is void, you know. And at the same time, open, you know, it's got this function of a paperclip. We use it as a paperclip. You know, so that's that. You get the idea here. Transparent on eight sides. So transparent on all sides. Transparent on all. We just need to see it. Transparent on all sides. Without form, without eye, spring takes its shape. Isn't that beautiful? Without form, without eye, spring takes its shape. I had a look at when I was sitting on my deck this morning reading through this, and we have a tree and it's already full yellow, the leaves. It's autumn, you know. Without eye, without form, autumn takes its shape. You know, that is again a beautiful image of the great functioning of it all. You know, there's actually no one there. Nothing there that drives it, you know. Unobstructed and unhindered, the moon travels through the firmament. Unobstructed and unhindered, the moon travels through the firmament. Actually, there is no such thing as an obstruction. There is no such thing. When you look at from the perspective of this oneness, when you look at it from the perspective of our true self, that word obstruction is just a sound. There is no such thing. There is no such thing as obstruction. It is totally unobstructed. Unobstructed. Unhindered. There's no such thing as unhindered. It's unavoidable. The moon travels through the firmament. Pure treasure eyes, arms of virtue. So pure treasure eyes, the way I look at that is no intermediary. If we can see beyond the identity, no intermediary, that is pure. That is what is pure. I am no longer, it's like obstructions are shielding that purity. Saying that this is a paperclip is shielding it. You know, saying that I am I or Arno is shielding it. You know, so that's purity. You know, purity. Pure treasure eyes, you know, pure treasure eyes. Arms of virtue. How can there not be arms of virtue? You know, virtue in the sense, it's not moralistic. Virtue is functioning. That is it's just the functioning of it all, the functioning of everything that happens in the universe. And what it does is what our practice does. The practice of letting go, of course, is what we practice. The practice of letting go of the I gets us to purify our mind, and you know, actually stop being confused about it. That doesn't mean to say we can't say this is a paperclip. It doesn't mean we can't say this is right and this is wrong. But we are no longer confused about it. We're no longer stuck. The whole body and the entire body, how do they compare with each other? So he takes that from the Koan, and he says, okay, one said the whole body, the other one says the entire body. Remember, the whole body, he said, was only 80% of it, and the entire body supposedly 100% maybe. How do they compare with each other? So he's now asking that question. The hands and eyes at this moment manifest the entire activity. So that's the great functioning, the great activity, the great function. The hands and the eyes at this moment, you could even say hands and eyes, my hands and eyes, you know, at this very moment, manifest the entire activity, seamless, absolutely seamless. And if we don't see it, that's because we're stuck in separation. We're seeing it as my hands, not your hands. Again, just the hands, just the eyes. Okay? The hands, the eyes at this moment manifest the entire activity. The great functions, vertical and horizontal. How could they detest anything at all? How could they detest anything at all? There is no such thing as detesting. There's nothing to be detested. You know, there's just the functioning. So after the Taisho, we chant the four great vows.